Okay. So it's a great pleasure to be here. Thank you to the organizers for setting up this very cool workshop. I'm looking forward to it, and I'm a bit nervous to get things started, but hopefully this will be a good discussion to begin with, and we'll just keep going upwards from here. So what I'm going to be talking about today is supersymmetry constraints in heterotic theories and some of the global consequences of supersymmetry in heterotic theories that you might not expect. This is work done that was in collaboration with James Gray and Andre Lucas from Oxford and Bert Overit at UPenn. And it's based on a series of papers that came out last year and early this year, and several that are to appear shortly. So what I'm going to talk about is the E8 cross E8 heterotic string and supersymmetric vacua in this theory. I'm going to try and motivate the general problem of understanding supersymmetry in heterotic theories, why we're interested in this, and why it's a difficult thing to guarantee in general. I'm going to talk about some mathematics, specifically slope stability of vector bundles, which is a problem in algebraic geometry, and just going to motivate how this is normally thought of in terms of algebraic geometry. And then, lest that seem scary, I'm going to try and rephrase this question in terms of one in the 4D effective field theory, and try and make some hairy mathematics look less complicated. I'm going to introduce a new contribution to the potential that models this behavior, and I want to discuss some of the consequences of supersymmetry. So you probably all have heard over the last year lots of discussion in string model building, debates between global local model building. I'm going to use the word global here to mean the overarching structure of the theory, not just anomaly cancellation, as it frequently is, but basically rather than one specific model, just the structure of the theory in general, and some of the consequences, specifically how you can see connections between different types of geometries, different types of string vacua, and various constraints on the phenomenology that you might expect from heterotic models within this context. So just a review of the ball game that we're going to be working in. We're going to be working in heterotic M theory, so we can view this in either 10 or 11 dimensions. From the 11-dimensional picture, one direction is an interval, an S1 mod Z2, and on the fixed planes of this interval is where we're going to do physics. So we have two fixed planes with enhanced E8 gauge symmetry at each one. We're hopefully going to build something like the standard model at one of these fixed planes and then compactify down to four dimensions to get an effective field theory. And propagating in this extra direction, we can admit fibrains, in general M5 brains, which I'll discuss a little bit. And this is the basic picture that we want to have in mind. So that part I'm sure is familiar. Another general reminder of the arena that we're talking about here. So we're going to start with either 11 dimensions or 10, and the E8 cross E8 heterotic string. As I just said, we want to do model building in principle in one of these E8s. So we're going to embed some vector bundle on top of a compact Calabi-Yau threefold, which is going to have a structure group, the presence of which will break E8 down to the standard model, something containing the standard model. This is going to be a holomorphic vector bundle, and in general, we're going to consider gauge groups SUN so that their commutator inside E8 is going to be E6, SO10, or SU5. As is familiar to everybody, we're going to have some matter fields and some moduli in this problem. In general, the geometric moduli are just going to be the Kähler and complex structure moduli of the Calabi-Yau threefold. And there will also be moduli associated to the vector bundle that I've placed over this Calabi-Yau threefold. And matter fields, which are going to live in bundle-valued cohomology groups, as usual. Okay, so supersymmetry in heterotic. The condition is very easy to state, and not so easy to solve, sadly. So if we begin with the 10-dimensional E8 cross E8 Lagrangian, we get a very simple condition from supersymmetry, which is the familiar Hermitian-Yang-Mills equations. So the Gugino variation tells us simply that the field strength of, in principle, our E8 vector bundle has to satisfy two conditions, here and here, where these indices are going to run over the holomorphic indices of the Calabi-Yau threefold. The first condition is easy to satisfy. This is simply the statement that the vector bundle is holomorphic. And the second condition is what we usually refer to as the Hermitian-Yang-Mills condition. This is just the trace of the field strength equals zero. In general, as is obvious, the solution to this depends on all the moduli in the problem. So you have this big multidimensional moduli space, you set yourself down at a point, and in general, you may have a solution at some points in this moduli space, but not at others. So the question could be asked, suppose I vary my moduli. I start at some point where I have a solution, and I vary the moduli such that supersymmetry is broken. What happens in the effective field theory? Is there a nice four-dimensional description of this geometric breakdown in terms of this vector bundle? And it's pretty easy to see that, in fact, there should be a new positive definite contribution to the potential that describes this breaking of supersymmetry in part of a moduli space. So let's just motivate briefly. I'm going to bring all this up at once. How this comes about. By the way, I'm sorry if on this side of the room I'm blocking anything. Let me know if I'm standing in your way here. So beginning with the 10-dimensional Lagrangian, just a part of it here, we have two F terms, trace F squared terms. This is one for each E8, one and two, and a trace R squared term. We have a Bianchi identity that these field strengths and curvature satisfies in terms of the three form. And we can do something very simple with this Bianchi identity. This is, by the way, this is anomaly cancellation in 10 dimensions. We can simply wedge this with a Kähler form and integrate. So we have a condition that this is zero. I'm going to expand the field strength and the curvature in a basis of 1-1 forms. And note that to lowest order, my Calabi-Yau is going to be chosen to be Ricci flat for this standard heterotic compactification. And now I'm going to assume that the Kähler moduli, to start with, can vary, and I'm going to hold everything else fixed. So if I do that in 10 dimensions, I simply have this condition, where I've expanded out these trace F wedge F terms in terms of trace F squareds, minus something that looks familiar from our supersymmetry condition. And I can substitute this into my general 10-dimensional Lagrangian, and I see that I have two terms appearing in 10 dimensions, which have only internal Calabi-Yau indices visible on them, so they're going to contribute to the potential in four dimensions. And these things are going to be zero. Let me do this here. They're going to be zero if I satisfy supersymmetry, namely the Hermitian-Yang-Mills equations, and they're going to be non-zero if I don't. So very simply stated, these things are positive semi-definite. So if I vary, say, the Kähler moduli such that I'm not solving Hermitian-Yang-Mills, these things are present and part of the potential. If I do satisfy the Hermitian-Yang-Mills equations, this particular part of the potential will be zero. Okay, great. So I know that I expect some non-trivial contribution to the potential from a failure to satisfy the Hermitian-Yang-Mills equations. However, what I've just shown you isn't very useful because I know virtually nothing about this potential in its explicit form. For standard heterotic compactifications, I don't know the field strength or the metric of the Calabi-Yau except numerically.
So is that just phi Lupulus term that you're generating if you don't preserve Susie?
It will contain a phi Eliopoulos term, which I'm going to get to in just a second, but there's going to be a bit more to it. Yes, so I don't know these guys, but this is what I want to derive in the first part of my talk, is explicitly showing you what this potential is, and it's going to involve a D-term, as Miriam correctly guesses.
It's well known on the differing side, right? It's very similar.
So people have said this, and I always find this interesting, because I'm not as familiar with that literature. So there's very clearly analogous situations that are very well known on the type 2 side. But has anyone looked at the exact analog, which would be stack some brains, put a non-abelian connection on your brain, and then look at what's going to turn out to be the stability of the non-abelian brain on a stack of D brains, and ask what the effective field theory looks like? Because there's some stuff that clearly, for example, you would get a very similar field theory to what we're going to see here. But has anyone actually done that one?
The field theory I'm about to show you in a few slides here. Sorry.
So, this constant Fallopoulos term is only generated for E1.
See the point, but one has to make a non-abelian bundle somehow here, and the question is, in type 2, did people really take a non-abelian bundle on a stack of these brains and then look at the boundaries of it? And as far as...
No, I think that's not the case. Mostly they're looking at one bundles.
Right, that was our impression.
So we're getting a little ahead of the game here in that we haven't seen the field theory yet. So let me show you the field theory. This analogs of this are going to turn up all over the place, both in other heterotic contexts and in type 2. So I'll show you some of the parallels of things that'll look very familiar and some of the things that may be new. But the first part of my talk is going to be showing you where this potential comes from, and then we'll do some interesting stuff with it. Okay, so as we just said, supersymmetry If you can solve the Hermitian-Young-Mills equations, you can guarantee that you have a supersymmetric vacuum. Unfortunately, these are a wickedly hard set of PDEs to solve, and you need a very big computer to do this numerically. To some extent, you're saved by algebraic geometry. Due to Donaldson, Uhlenbeck, et al., there is a very nice theorem that tells you you can translate this differential geometry problem into an algebraic problem, which is namely that if the vector bundle in the Kolobiow satisfies a certain geometric property, namely that it is something called polystable, then you have a solution. So the specific theorem is that on each polystable holomorphic vector bundle, there exists a Hermitian-Young-Mills connection satisfying these equations, and it is unique. So what does it mean to be polystable? Well, polystable is something that is determined in terms of a number called the slope. The slope is simply a quasi-topological quantity. It is an integral of the first string class of your vector bundle wedged in with two Kähler forms and integrated over the Kolobiow divided by the rank of the bundle. Here, J is going to be my Kähler form. TK are my familiar Kähler parameters, and omega K is a basis of 1-1 forms on my Kolobiow. So this number is the slope. The bundle is called stable if, for every subsheaf, and we'll talk more about how you figure these guys out in a minute, if you somehow have a list of every subsheaf in your bundle that has a rank less than your bundle, if you compute this number for every bit of substructure of your bundle and compare it to the vector bundle itself, it better be small. Okay? If it is, then the bundle is stable, and it's called polystable if you can write down a direct sum of such things. Okay. So this is the notion of slope stability from algebraic geometry. Unfortunately, this is a case of conservation of misery. You've rephrased the question in terms of algebraic geometry, but it's still really hard to prove a vector bundle is slope stable. And the tricky part, just go back one slide here, the tricky part is exactly in terms of this subsheaf structure. So just computing this number is easy. Figuring out what all the substructure is of a given vector bundle is a hard thing to do. So if you were handed a list of exactly how to break your vector bundle up into pieces, then you could analyze this and decide if you had a solution to Hermitian-Young-Mills. So, yeah, given a vector bundle...
Typically, if I were Kolobiow, right, that Morgan,
Witten,
Donaghi approach
so,
allowed you to classify
who is stable? So what the spectral cover construction gives you is it gives you a guaranteed solution for one particular region in moduli space. It doesn't give you an understanding of a generally in moduli space, whether you have a solution everywhere.
Is there a cone in which this is stable?
Yes, it does give you a region in Kähler moduli space where it's stable. However, you might want to consider Kolobiows that are not elliptically fibered, for example, and vector bundles over them. But I'll talk a little bit about spectral covers in just a few seconds.
And maybe going back to this, I'm sorry, to this non-abelian. I mean, on type 2 side, you can formulate in type 2b or type 1. Can you formulate a theory with non-abelian?
You certainly can, and actually Aspinwall,
yeah.
Aspinwall has looked a little bit at this among other people.
I think you guys did too, right?
I think if you just use type 1, where you have divine brains, and then you can reduce it essentially to what you could do.
Yes, and you can talk about...
I agree that it's more complicated than, say, the 7 brains, and in addition, the vector bundle on the 7 brain, which means more like a sheaf.
So there is an analogous condition, which is just like this. This is pi stability, which is the analogous condition for, say, D7 brains with non-abelian gauge fluxes. And you could do a very similar analysis there.
So
you have to work...
direct duality map.
Unfortunately, the cases of interest, I'm not sure, are simply dual to one another in terms of what you want to do for model building. But you're right that, in general, you could ask very similar questions on the type 2 side.
So I was actually going to ask about the analogy with pi stability, and that the main burden of Douglas's work was to extend the correct notion of stability to small volumes.
Mm-hmm.
And here, since you're talking about the Kähler moduli dependence of the stability condition...
I'm assuming I'm at large volume.
So do you actually know the generalization to small volume, analogous to the type 2 generalization?
No. I'm going to talk about...
We know one correction to it, right?
Yeah.
You know the leading upper bound correction?
Yes.
We know leading upper bound, and we know geometrically where it comes from, and I imagine lower amount.
Yeah. We're going to be talking about expansions in heterotic M theory in expansions to the 11-dimension Newton parameter, and I'm going to talk about the next leading order correction. But...
And there's a one loop correction as well.
Yes. Depending, one loop field theoretically. Yes.
Yeah, that's right. So it's warping in the strong.
Yep. Okay. So. Motivation, in general, if I hand you some vector bundle on a Kolobiow, you want to do some heterotic model building, you have to decide, in order to control supersymmetry, whether this thing is slope stable or find an explicit numeric solution to the Hermitian-Young-Mills equations. And in general, that's tough. So I'm not going to completely solve this problem from an effective field theory point of view, but I want to show you in effective field theory an easier way to think about what this is. So if you ask someone to intuitively decide what it means for a vector bundle to be slope stable, that isn't the most obvious thing. So I'm going to give us a physicist approach to how you can think about this and then show you some stuff you can do with it. So at the moment, I just want to preserve n equals 1 vacua in the low-energy compactification. In order to do phenomenology, I then have to add some non-perturbative effects to break it.
I thought you were talking about a potential energy that takes you away from...
If I fail to satisfy this, I break supersymmetry at the string scale, I mean the compactification scale.
I'm just asking why you're talking about it. So you're talking about this potential which came from the F-squared terms.
Yes.
Which is not, you know, dynamically small.
Yes.
And yet you're talking about restricting to a 4D effect.
Theory, so I'm just wondering what loading you did. Absolutely. So I'm going to answer that question in more detail in just a couple of slides. When I introduce this potential, I'll show you where it's valid and where it's not. And yeah, when you consider this thing being non-zero, it's not valid for long. You're going to excite KK modes quickly. Okay. So let me just rewrite this geometric condition briefly so I can draw some pretty diagrams. If I write down the slope of some vector bundle, I can expand this out in terms of the Kähler moduli in the Calabi-Yau and the triple intersection numbers, here dikh. And I can introduce a new coordinate, which I'm going to call a dual Kähler coordinate, which is just the intersection numbers contracted into two Kähler moduli. Now, the only reason I'm introducing this coordinate is it's going to be simpler to draw some pictures and describe where things are slope stable and where they're not. In terms of this new coordinate that I've just defined S, then the slope of my sheaf or vector bundle F is simply the dot product of the C1 vector into this new Kähler coordinate S. So I know that for an SUN vector bundle, which is going to be of primary interest to me in heterotic model building, C1 is 0. So I know that if I have some subsheaf inside V, which is going to destabilize it, then I have to have the dot product of the C1 of this subsheaf into these dual Kähler moduli being greater than or equal to 0. So I can do this in any number of dimensions, but let me just do this in two dimensions so that this is just a right angle condition for two different vectors.
So if you have U1 bundle, mm-hmm. you have also issues associated with U1?
So U1s are automatically slope stable. The problem, so a line bundle is automatically stable. It has no substructure. The problem there is the C1 of the line bundle and whether that U1 will embed into E8 or not. So in general, you need the condition that C1 wedge J equals 0 for a line bundle. But I'm going to talk about higher rank objects for right now.
But you can discuss the system breaking the line bundles as well, right?
There it's just topological. So for what I'm discussing in heterotic, you either have supersymmetry everywhere or, for a particular Kähler moduli, or you don't. We'll get back to this in just a second. Okay, so just to draw an explicit picture to get us oriented to the kind of thing we're going to consider, let me do this in two dimensions. And I did this for an explicit bundle just so I'd have something to point at.
I'm sorry to us, just sure. Making more. But if you're looking at orbitals, right, mm-hmm. which is different from smooth commutative, for specific constructions, you have typically universal anomalous in mind.
Mm-hmm. So, okay, what...
The Lupulus term associated with that.
Sorry?
It's like one loop, no?
It's one loop
effect,
yes.
So it's there. But
it's not this tree level. I understand that, yeah. So
and it is true that you could ask, so for a given line bundle, you have to satisfy that its slope vanishes in order to satisfy Hermitian-Yang-Mills for a line bundle with slope zero. In heterotic, that's not of interest to us because we can't do model building with that. You would have totally trivial everything. You would have, way too big structure group and no cohomology to give you matter fields. But in general, you could ask about what happens if you vary the Kähler moduli such that the slope is not zero. And that will fall into the same sort of discussion I'm having here. Okay, so slope stability of a vector bundle. I'm just going to pick a toy model to point out here. This is an SU3 bundle defined by a monad sequence, which is simply a short exact sequence. I have two different sums of line bundles here, separated by some map F. And I'm going to define a bundle that is the kernel of that map between two sums of line bundles. This is a simple example. And I picked this one just to point out because this particular simple bundle has only one bit of substructure that matters. This thing is destabilized precisely by one object, which is a rank 2 subbundle. In this case, it's not even a subsheaf. This thing is a bundle, which is just a subpiece of this monad. So in terms of these dual coordinates that I just introduced, I can draw a picture which just is some right angles. So this S space up to the line with slope 1/2 is just my Kähler moduli, allowable. I can draw a line in the plane here that corresponds to the C1 of some subsheaf, here, this particular point in Kähler moduli space, and the right angle from it, everything above this line is going to be unstable, which means, geometrically speaking, that I have no solution to Hermitian-Yang Mills, and everything below this line is going to be stable. Okay?
Another question? Is it ever possible in the M-theory picture to emit 5 grains and restore stability?
Excellent question. I'm going to talk about that in a little bit later. But yes, 5 brains will come into the story later. Okay. So I gave you this example of a bundle. There is some particular subsheaf that's destabilizing it, some subsheaf that matters in terms of determining the substructure in Kähler moduli space where you have supersymmetry or you don't. So on a line in this 2D picture, or in general a hyperplane in Kähler moduli space, there is some subsheaf of the bundle that becomes important, something that matters. It turns out that locally at least, and in our case globally, I can always describe my bundle in terms of knowing this subsheaf. If somebody hands me this subsheaf, I can very simply define my vector bundle as an extension sequence in terms of this subsheaf and everything that's left over. And the space of such extensions is in general given by this group, the X1 of these 2 pieces of substructure of my bundle, where the origin of this X group is something special. The origin is where this thing can be written simply as a direct sum of these 2 pieces, the subsheaf that's causing me problems and everything else. And these 2 C1s of these 2 subobjects are correlated because I need to have an SUN bundle total. So, fine, I have some subsheaf. I know how to geometrically describe my bundle in terms of it. Now, let's consider what happens on this line in Kähler moduli space, or in my dual Kähler moduli space, where I have a boundary, at least in Kähler moduli space, between supersymmetry and no supersymmetry. What's happening here is the slope of this subsheaf here is greater than 0, here is less than 0, and on this line it's exactly 0.
So you're doing that for toroid-wide.
Sorry? This is any Calabia.
Oh, I saw some weighted.
Oh, sorry, this particular example, yeah. So everything I'm saying applies in general, but this particular example, thank you, I should have mentioned that. This is just a very simple complete intersection, Calabia threefold, which is defined as a single hypersurface in a product of 2 projective spaces. Unweighted, in this case. Okay, sorry. So there's some line where mu of f equals 0. So I know if I were to go back a couple slides to my supersymmetry conditions, because the slope of this thing is exactly equal to that of my bundle, it can only satisfy supersymmetry in the case that it's not properly stable, but polystable. So I need to be able to write this thing as a direct sum of some other bundles. In this case, on this line, I will only have supersymmetry if I can write it as a direct sum of 2 pieces. So let's just ask what happens. Suppose I was going to have a supersymmetric solution. I know that within this general moduli space, X1 here, describing the area near where this bundle can be written as a direct sum of 2 pieces, there is exactly one point where this thing breaks into 2. So let me ask what happens near this point in bundle moduli space. Here the structure group is going to change. I'm going to go from an SU3 structure group into an S of U2 times U1, which is locally just SU2 times U1. And because my visible Bordier effective field theory is the commutant of this structure group inside E8, the 4-dimensional theory is going to pick up an extra U1 because this U1 piece is going to commute with itself inside E8. So what's going
to
It will be, but it's going to have, so yes, it will be FI breaking, but there's going to be some interesting features. So the visible structure group in this particular toy model is going to change to E6 times U1, and there's some new U1 that's generated in the visible 4D theory. Okay. As is familiar in many other contexts in string theory, as Miriam just mentioned, I'm going to get this extra new U1, and the enhanced U1 is anomalous. It's canceled by the Green-Schwarz mechanism. And what's going to happen at this particular point in Kähler moduli space, I have this new U1 appearing in the theory, and everything in the problem is going to be charged under it in principle. So all the matter fields and what I used to think of as moduli are now charged under this extra U1. So locally, inside E8, I'm dealing with E6 times SU2 times U1. I can decompose the 248 of E8 in terms of this new set of groups instead of my standard E6 times SU3 theory. And all the things that I would normally call matter and moduli pick up U1 charges, which I've written here as subscripts. So in particular, I can look at the bundle moduli The bundle moduli decompose into three parts. Normally, this is H1 of nV, which is uncharged under E6. But now I'm going to have three parts, one of which is a singlet under this new U1, and two parts of opposite charge under the new U1. And likewise, since this is an E6 theory, I can look at the 27s and 27 bars. They also pick up a U1 charge at this point. More interestingly, perhaps, the complexified Kähler moduli also transform with a shift symmetry through this new U1, through their axion, as is standard with the Green-Schwarz mechanism. And the dilaton and M5 brain position moduli also will pick up charges under this U1, which we'll come back to your question in just a minute. But this is at higher order, and I'm going to talk about the tree level result first. This enhanced U1 symmetry, as Miriam correctly guessed, is just going to lead to a U1 D-term contribution to the 4D effective potential. So I can just open up Wessenbagger, write down the D-term associated to this anomalous U1, and I find something rather remarkable. I find that field theoretically, all that happens at this split locus is that the D-term associated to this U1 consists of a simple GCC term, where this is all the matter in the problem charged under this U1, with an FI term. This FI term is exactly the geometric slope that I introduced talking about slope stability, divided by the volume of the Calabi-L. Okay, so here's the field theoretic description of what's going on. This is the explicit form of the potential described earlier by dimensional reduction. So we're going to demonstrate how this effective field theory gives us all the features that we're used to.
One second. Mm-hmm. When we worked with these U1 bundles, the D-term had a one-loop contribution.
So which I will get to in just a minute.
So you are at the moment only looking at the tree-level term, yeah?
Yep, okay. I'm going to show you what happens with that, and then we'll talk about what happens at 1 minute. Okay, sorry. Okay. So at this Wall and Kähler moduli space, my vector bundle is breaking into these two parts. For this particular example, sum rank 2 subsheaf plus a line bundle. For this particular example, it has two 27s, no 27 bars, and 22 bundle moduli at an arbitrary point in Kähler moduli space. So this is the bundle that I started with. If I write down the spectrum at the line of semi-stability in the middle of this Kähler cone where I have this extra U1, I find that I have some uncharged bundle moduli, namely 7 of them for this example. Two of my 27s have charged minus a half, and so that's all of them in this case. And I have a bunch of charged bundle moduli, which I'm going to call C, which have in this case charged minus 3/2, 16 of those. Okay, so let's discuss what happens with this effective field theory and how we can rebuild this into the general bundle that I started with. We have this D term. In this particular example, you can write this out explicitly in terms of the Kähler moduli. And what we find is that in order to have supersymmetry, we need to be able to set the D term to 0. So I need to be able, both on the line and off of it, to find a solution to this equation. I'm going to assume that all the matter field vevs are set to 0 so that I solve the E6 D term as well. So geometrically, when the slope is less than 0, what happens? When the slope is less than 0, this quantity is negative. And it turns out that the C field vevs in this problem, because I've gotten rid of the 27s, these are just the bundle moduli that were charged now. The C field vevs adjust to keep D1 equals 0 and the supersymmetric vacuum. So as I expect from algebraic geometry, when the slope is negative, I have a solution. This vev, this particular bit of the bundle moduli, as it turns out, lives in exactly the X that I said described this extension description of my vector bundle. This vev exactly controls how I remix the two pieces of my vector bundle back together to form something indecomposable. Note that for this example, there were actually no positively charged matter, either 27s or bundle moduli. So what happens when the slope is greater than 0? Well, when the slope is greater than 0, these things cannot adjust to cancel it no matter what. There is no matter to cancel it. Therefore, I have no supersymmetric vacuum. I've broken supersymmetry through D-term breaking. When this thing is equal to 0, then the C field vevs can relax to 0 as well, which corresponds to breaking this bundle into two pieces, which is exactly the condition of polystability that we expected from the algebraic geometry. So, as I just said here, this thing equals 0 at the wall corresponds to the 0 in the X group, which is that the bundle breaks down. So, in the stable region, We know that because I have one D-term, one C-field that's getting Higgs, I'm removing one degree of freedom from the physical theory. So there is one constraint to keep D1 equals zero. So if I add up my various fields that I wrote down, I find this makes sense. I had 16 C-fields. I Higgs one of them to get 15, plus adding in the 7 uncharged bundle moduli gives me the 22 that I would expect from a standard compactification in the stable region. So if I were just counting geometrically what I would expect, that all works. The field theory is
situation that you cannot for changing by Leopold's term, which you understand exactly about
like brain position moduli, all of this. Yes, the field theory is not new at all.
You break Susius, you go in this regime, and that's it. So
D-term breaking is very familiar. The context that I'm describing it in was not familiar in Heterotic, and what we're about to do with it in the next slides is also going to be different. But I agree that field theoretically this is very familiar. And this is in some sense the point, right? I started with algebraic geometry, which is how we normally think about that, which is very difficult, and now I'm showing you a very familiar field theory.
In fact, just to mention, for example, Ralph has papers where he was model building on the line and using these U1s, and he has this D-term written down explicitly. So it's well known that this isn't a new field theory, it's just getting it from considering this.
Okay, so what has happened with this D-term breaking? I now can draw a picture like this in Kähler moduli space, where I have a supersymmetric region that's nice and flat, and I have a wonking great perturbative potential that pops up in part of field space, which is giving me supersymmetry breaking. Quick comment here. In the stable, I glossed over this a little bit faster. In the stable region, as Ralph and co pointed out looking at their split bundles, this D-term, in order to cancel it, it is not exactly the bundle moduli, but actually a linear combination of the bundle moduli and the Kähler moduli that get a VEV. And this vector rotates on the line itself. The Kähler moduli are getting Higgs, so this U1 is massive everywhere. It's at its lowest mass on the line, and as I move further into the stable region, this vector is rotating into the bundle moduli direction, and the U1 is getting heavier. Eventually, I can integrate it out of the theory. The mass of the U1. And the point is that as I do this Higgsing effect, this effective field theory is going to break down as I move away from the line. So this is only valid in this region of Kähler moduli space. And as I move far away from this region of Kähler moduli space, I return to the standard heterotic compactification with a supersymmetric bundle that I would expect. I can explore perturbatively near this region. In answer to the question of what happens if I tried to go on the other side where this potential is non-zero, very rapidly I'm going to excite KK modes and there is no effective field theory. So I'm going to lose control of the effective field theory as I go into the unstable region. Okay, so just to summarize what the point of this was, we noticed that the thing that gave us algebraic geometry was in fact the matter content of this particular theory. So the fact for this example that matter had all the same sign of charge under this enhanced U1 gave rise to stable and unstable regions as I analyzed this effective field theory. I showed you this for an example, and I gave you some counting as to how, with the Higgs effect, this added up. All of this is, in fact, general. You can prove it, and we did in our papers, that this sort of behavior is going to happen for any slope-stable vector bundle that transitions in this way. Just a note about the structure of this D-term, you might have expected from algebraic geometry that this depended on all the moduli in the problem, including the complex structure moduli, but you find that for a simple example of this type, the D-term does not, in fact, depend on the complex structure, only on the Kähler and bundle moduli.
Can I ask a question about that?
Sure.
I mean, the bundle moduli itself varies over the complex structure moduli space because H1 of ENDV mm-hmm. varies over bundle moduli over a complex structure moduli space. So
yes.
There must be some subtle sense in which the structure does change if you move to a non-generic complex structure.
Yes, and that's exactly, from an algebraic geometry point of view, that's exactly where the complex structure should come in that you would expect basically the HOMs of these subsheaves into your vector bundle to jump as you wiggle the complex structure.
So you're staying away from those loci when you say the D-term does not depend on complex
I'm saying that when you write down the effective field theory near this transition point, you find that that doesn't actually happen. So both, I tried geometrically to find examples that contradicted this, but in fact, this simple case, this seems to be a structure from the field theory and the geometry. Okay, so what happens at higher order? Everything I showed you was at the lowest order in the expansions in heterotic M theory in terms of the 11d Newton constant. So let's consider the next highest order, kappa 11 to the 4/3. What we find quickly here is that in heterotic M theory, when you do a dimensional reduction, in fact, what appears in the effective theory is not the Kähler moduli at the E8 fixed plane, but an average of those Kähler moduli over the interval, the S1 mod Z2. However, the bundle itself lives only on the fixed plane. We have an enhanced E8 only on the endpoints of this S1 mod Z2. And thus, you might expect that stability itself shouldn't be affected by the average Kähler moduli in this 11-dimensional picture, but just the Kähler moduli that live at the fixed plane. Turns out that this is exactly the right idea. So if you adjust for this difference, if you subtract off exactly this averaging of the Kähler moduli, you find precisely the form of the kappa 11 to the 4/3 corrections. So your full D term is once again an Fi term with some C bar terms. At tree level, you can write this Fi term as some kappa 11 to the 2/3 piece plus this next leading order correction. And we find the new Fi term now depends not only on the C1 slope of the bundle, but also on the dilaton and the M5 brain position moduli. So the moral of the story is the notion of slope stability has not changed. This is still slope stability of the vector bundle on the fixed point, but from a heterotic M theory point of view, you have to compensate at next leading order for this averaging. And interestingly enough, you can wiggle the M5 brains and change the position of supersymmetry. So all of this couples to next leading order.
But the new slope for which you have to test is the one including this one loop correction, right?
So in terms of the effective field theory, the full thing is including this one loop correction. But I'm saying that in terms of algebraic geometry, it's actually the fact that what you wrote down at tree level wasn't quite the right thing that you're subtracting off again at next to leading order. So slope stability to this order has not changed, but what appears in the field theory you need to compensate for.
If you'd written field theory in a really daft choice of fields, so you wrote your entire field theory in terms of the values for all the Kähler moduli evaluated on that fixed plane, then you would see it was just purely the slope, full stop, normal slope. There wouldn't be any correction.
But this is dual to the pi stability criterion.
Yeah,
right?
I don't know how
that
works.
Their stability does change.
I don't know how this works in the duality to that, but you can work this out just explicitly, because you know from the field theory what the correction is at next order. And then I can just sit down and I can work out, I know the warping, I know the background explicitly, and you can just see if it reproduces the right correction. And it does up to all the factors, everything perfectly matches. So here, there is no connection to the notion of slope at that order. But you're right, it'd be really interesting to find out, and Ralph mentioned this before, how that maps to isolation.
And as we've said, everything here is deliberately at large volume. So there could be various small volume corrections that we're not considering.
But so again, these GS, they map into the alpha prime corrections of pi stability, right? And
I think that's right, yeah.
So you say for brains, the stability gets corrected by these higher corrections?
I don't know what the G. So, for example, if I'd written this down in weakly coupled heterotic string theory, I wouldn't have had this geometric interpretation. So, if I'd written this, I'm using the 11th dimension to give a geometric correction interpretation to this correction. And if I'd written that in the weakly coupled 10D language, then I wouldn't have been able to do that. How this maps across to pi stability and whether there's a nice geometrical interpretation of the first correction there, I have no idea.
And I think, in fact, I mean, this is a very interesting question in general about pi stability. I mean, the geometric interpretation of these additions to mu stability are something that I think isn't very well understood and would be very interesting to look at in terms of, you know, geometrically what you're building there. But yeah, I don't know about the exact duality chain and what that looks like on the other side. Maybe we could discuss bits more after. Okay. So now let me do something with this field theory. So I just showed you that we can take slope stability, which is ugly and confusing, and we can think about this in terms of D-term breaking in an effective field theory.
Sorry, may I ask one more?
Sure.
So without the, and this extra piece was JJF equals zero, and the original equation, right? The
C1 of F, yes.
Yes. Mm-hmm. So in your case, would you say this extra piece has to be added to this point-wise or not?
In terms of, sorry, point-wise in Kähler moduli space?
Yes. It's the news.
I mean, they certainly correlate. You have to do this, you know, Kähler modulus at a time. I mean, you ask the question, yeah. Field theoretically, this doesn't make sense as an effective field theory except at this locus. So
the field theory doesn't get changed, so that it will still be JJF in 10D.
Yes.
That's what you're saying?
Yes.
Sorry, in 11D. I should be careful.
Okay. Exactly, so because of the averaging.
In 10D, of course, there will be a correction. Because
and this can be one correction.
Exactly, yeah. But in 11D, yep. On evaluated on the fixed plane, so in the 10D plane in the 11D theory,
then you have...
It will be JJA.
Yep.
Kill me now. Yeah. Actually, the pi... Sorry, the pi stability connection is perhaps something that, you know, these morning discussions, that would be something I would, the correction to that, the connection to that is something I'd be interested in.
I would agree. Okay. All right, so going back to this, we've taken slope stability, ugly geometric condition. We've written in terms of a very simple and familiar effective field theory in terms of D term Suzy breaking and a Fi term associated to an anomalous U1. Now let me do some more complicated, perhaps, things with this. I told you in this effective field theory that I reproduce slope stability because of the charges on the matter. So if all the matter was present with the same sign of U1 charge, I said I had slope stability. What happens if I had just written down this theory and I had had both signs of U1 charge? So suppose I had had both types of C fields here, living in two different X groups that are not isomorphic, two different signs of C charge. Then geometrically, I know that these different X groups control two different extension sequences, one for a bundle V in terms of a subsheaf F, and some other bundle V twiddle in terms of a subsheaf K. And if I had both of these types of C field, then just from the D term description, I know that it would be possible to satisfy D equals 0 for both mu of F less than 0 and mu of F greater than 0. Both of these guys are SUN. So what gives? What happens to the story I just told you? What happened to my region of stability, walls, etc.? Well, the answer is that, in fact, in the case where I could have both signs of matter charge, a more complicated structure is possible. In fact, what's happening geometrically is that I have more than one vector bundle in play. Geometrically, I am no longer, if I have both types of matter here, constrained to the same geometry. So what happens is that these two extension bundles are, in fact, non-isomorphic. I can go further with this in terms of describing this geometry in a second. These bundles are both slope stable, and they share some locus in their moduli space, this decomposable locus where this enhanced U1 appears. But in fact, in general, they are very different. They have different stability regions, different low energy spectrum, and entirely different theories. So beginning with just one bundle, which I've analyzed and found some subsheaf F, I can write down this boundary wall in Kähler moduli space where I break supersymmetry, and I may get some intuition as to what can be, what can happen on the other side. So I'm going to do this just for one bundle. Suppose that I started in the stable region of my bundle V2 here. There could be some other bundle V1 which is connected on the other side of moduli space with very different property, sharing this line. And in terms of bundle moduli, there are two non-isomorphic bundle moduli spaces which share a single point, namely the point where the bundle breaks into two pieces. Now, this can happen for much more than just two bundles, but let me discuss this for a pair of them. What's happening mathematically in this case? Physically, I'm telling you that this enhanced U1, this part of Kähler moduli space where this enhanced U1 appears, is somehow the key to deciding geometrically what is connected to what, which bundles are related, and how might I actually transition between them. So physically, the canonical structure of some vector bundle is given by this sum of subsheaves that I can break into to give me this extra U1. Many different bundles and different geometries can be connected through the same one, same decomposition. Mathematically, in fact, this is exactly the right notion to describe what's going on. Mathematically, when I have a vector bundle that is not properly slope stable, but what's called slope semi-stable, so this thing has some subsheaf with exactly the same slope as my bundle, then I can no longer talk about its moduli space in the way that I want to. Normally, I'd like to talk about a moduli space where I fix a point in this moduli space and I have a vector bundle. But for things that are not properly slope stable, I can no longer do that. It turns out that you need Mumford's geometric invariant theory. The problem is that for semi-stable objects, if you fix a point in moduli space, you cannot define a Hausdorff moduli space without grouping these bundles into larger sets. You need some notion of an equivalence class in order to talk about a moduli space. Geometrically, this is known as an S-equivalence class for semi-stable sheaves. So what S-equivalence classes are, mathematically, is simply a filtration of my vector bundle in terms of subsheaves, such that all the slopes of all the pieces equal that of the bundle. And an S-equivalence class is defined by something called a grading, or a graded sum. This is simply quotients of these subsheaves. And two bundles are called S-equivalent, i.e. they live at the same point in this general moduli space if they have the same graded sum. Okay, so mathematically, specifying a direct sum of these quotiented subsheaves fully specifies a point in the broader moduli space of semi-stable bundles. So why have I shown you this? Simply to say that mathematically and physically the notions are entirely the same. You can have large webs of geometries that are connected by the same slope stability properties, not in all of Kähler moduli space, but in a transitional region where supersymmetry changes.
On the physical side, all that happened was a field with charge plus got a bed instead of a field with charge minus.
Exactly.
So and you might have said that in such a complicated way with the graded sum here. Does that apply also with many U1s or something?
Yes. Okay. So with many U1s and much more than two pieces. So I agree that from field theory, if I just have matter of both sides, this is totally easy. And field theoretically, the fact that I should have these flat directions is no surprise. What is that if I had handed you two different vector bundles, you might have had no notion that there was any kind of physical connection between the two. And for an arbitrary vector bundle, this type of substructure is very non-obvious. So being able to view this in a transitional way and say, actually, what's happening is that you're probing this S-equivalence class simply by giving bevs to things in the 4D theory is something that, A, mathematicians would find very surprising that there was this simple description, and shows you that your mathematical notion of slope stability and your effective field theory are giving you the same thing. Okay, this is just a massy point here, but an interesting thing as well is that this type of graded sum and this classification has been used in the mathematics literature to try and count Donaldson-Thomas invariants, which count the number of topologically equivalent slope-stable vector bundles on Kolobiows. So there is a nice question here of whether you can use this type of effective field theory to get a bit further counting Donaldson-Thomas invariants. In fact, you can do something even a little bit more tricky. One thing I should point is that the spectrum can change in these two different transitions. So as I move across this wall, I can have entirely different spectrum, but I have to preserve the topological index. It's possible that instead of just canceling this Fi term with two different signs of bundle moduli, I could use matter as well. So in this simple E6 example, suppose that I used, to cancel this Fi term, matter charged under E6. So suppose, for example, I had 27s with a plus 1, 27 bar with a minus 1, 27 with a minus a half, and some bundle moduli that are also charged under this U1, then it might be possible to satisfy the D term equals 0 and the U1 equals 0, DU1, using, say, E6 charge moduli to cancel the Fi term on the other side of the wall. So what's happening there? In this case, two bundles of different ranks could be connected. So I could move from an E6 theory to an SO10 theory, an SU5 theory. It would be if I was changing topology. I am not changing topology in this one, so the index stays the same, unlike in a small instanton transition.
There was chirality issue here, talking about different gauge groups.
One issue here is that in the base, nothing is going singular in this process. So I'm not collapsing any cycles to zero to do this. You could ask what happens if you did have something like a small instanton transition in this type of geometric picture, and that's something that we're considering. But at the moment, nothing is singular here. This is separate, so I'm not dissolving M5 brains.
I'm sorry, I'm harping on you so much, but similar things again happen, right?
This is very true. Similar things happen. But this had not happened in heterotic before, in terms of slope stability. And I'll show you a little bit more. Okay, so two supersymmetric theories.
Just one question which may be unrelated to the main discussion. But I mean, this, what you call E6 matters, the 27 bar, which is a singlet with respect to the SU2 and the doublet, so 27. Mm-hmm. That is a coset space of E8 over E6 times SU2 goes to 1. And
yes.
It's a supersymmetric sigma model, which is where you have the full E8 realized on that. Does that play any role, the symmetry, or is that just?
Yes. So, I mean, from the effective field theory description, the fact that I have. Let me hesitate here. In terms of the effective field theory, the fact that I have an anomaly-free theory matters a lot in both the sigma model description and in the effective field theory. So if I understand your question correctly, could I have made a similar analysis in terms of the sigma model? Yes, absolutely, if I add the full geometric dictionary. Okay, so two different supersymmetric theories could be connected in their vacuum space. I can change the structure group. So if I'm interested in, you know, moving between different gut theories and heterotic, I could roll across these directions that I now know exist and connect different geometries. And field theoretically, it's not surprising that these things have flat directions, but geometrically, finding out which webs of bundles are connected is a much less trivial thing. And as someone just pointed out, I've described this for the case of one enhanced U1. But in fact, if I have a higher rank vector bundle that doesn't just break into two pieces, I can get more than one anomalous U1 in the picture, which makes for many more branches possible from this effective field theory. Thinking about it. Okay, so I've talked a lot about this theory near the line, how I can connect different geometries to one another. But you might say, okay, I'm interested in heterotic model building. I'm interested in starting in some supersymmetric vacuum. Why do I care about this theory? Why do I care about this global effect of the fact that there is this stability wall? I said before that this U1 is Higgs as I move away from this wall. So if I write down this theory with this enhanced U1, this theory is only valid in a very small region of moduli space. As I begin varying the Kalin moduli, this U1 gets heavy, and as it approaches the compactification scale, I have to integrate it out and ignore it. However, there are some rather sneaky ways in which the fact that this U1 existed at all for some part of moduli space can stick around to haunt me. So even in the stable region of moduli space, the presence of one of these stability walls can have dramatic consequences. Most importantly of these is that the superpotential in my n equals 1 theory is holomorphic. So if I have written down my theory near the wall with U1 invariance, W is constrained near the wall. If, for example, some piece of my superpotential vanishes for some open region in Kalin moduli space near the wall, then I know that it has to vanish everywhere. So I can ask, what are the textures in, say, my Yukawa couplings, or say 27-27 bar couplings, near the wall, and what will happen to them as I move everywhere in moduli space? Can I deduce something global about this local behavior?
This is dangerous because a VEV develops as you move away from the wall, and that VEV is of a charged field, so it can cancel the problem with writing down the Yukawa. You can write down a higher dimension operator.
Yes, and I will talk about that.
And when the VEV is
and it could grow back, absolutely. Yes.
I'll grow back everything, right?
And as I'll just show you, that's an excellent point, and we did worry about this, and we're going to write down things that could not grow back ever, according to this mechanism. Okay, so again, why do you care? Well, we're interested in ultimately doing string model building. We're interested in ultimately writing down effective field theories that have, say, particles, spectrum, symmetries, very similar to the real world. If you weren't being careful about where your global supersymmetry properties were, if you weren't being careful about the entire substructure of Kalin, the substructure that could be present in Kalin moduli space, you might go to all the work of building a standard model only to discover that you could have no top Yukawa coupling, for example. So this is going to provide very powerful constraints on Yukawa couplings. What we find in general is that this is actually very dangerous. If you write down your average theory, you find that tons of things are forbidden that you'd like to be there due to these types of symmetries.
Well, we saw the same thing on the Dibrand side, and we introduced the instantons. So I think you should introduce Walshid instantons here.
And we have considered exactly that thing. So if you lose everything, how do you get it back?
The same thing on the quadratic side, the same idea.
Yeah, that's a very good point. So just one fine point here. I said that there were all these different geometries that were connected to one another from this wall, different transitions that I could happen. What happens to the type of argument? I told you the spectrum can change entirely. So what happens with this holomorphy argument as I try and move between branches? Well, what happens is that, in fact, any conclusions I'm going to draw about this U1 invariance and the vanishings of the superpotential will actually only apply for one branch, because the intersection between different branches as I move near this wall happen for a non-open intersection. I have to set the VEVs of the fields to zero. That is, I have to break my bundle completely apart in order to have this U1 before I can glue it back together again in a different way. So what I'm about to talk about will happen only for one branch, and I can do that analysis for each branch. And indeed, in addition just to trilinear couplings and things that could grow back at higher order, I could worry about constraints on vector-like pairs. So one of the things that happens a lot in heterotic model building is that you write down some bundle, it doesn't have quite the constraints, doesn't have quite the spectrum that you want. You have, for example, say it's an E6 model, some 27-27 bar pairs, and you say it's okay, I go along a flat direction, I get rid of these things. But you might find that in fact no such couplings can exist due to this type of structure. So just to give one other example of what you might do with this, suppose that you had a three-family SO10 model, which is described by some SU4 bundle V, with some stability wall somewhere in its moduli space. And on this wall, it breaks into two pieces, F1 and F2. And suppose I gave you a model that has some 16s of this theory, some matter that has charge +1, and some matter that's charge -1. And specifically, let me divide up my three 16s of my three-generation model into two with +1 charge and one with -1 charge. Then I'm going to say I have only one Higgs, which lives in this cohomology, single Higgs. And I have two different types of bundle moduli. So with such a three-family model, what could happen to me? Well, if I write down the theory at the wall, the only trilinear coupling I can write down is, in fact, between only one of these families. There's only one heavy family, so this is a Higgs 16-16 coupling. And if, for example, I had bundle moduli with charge minus 2, I could write down two other terms, as we were just discussing, things that could grow back, that correspond to moving away from this wall and giving C2 of EV. So in this branch, I would have one family perturbative on the wall, and two, that as this VEV of C gets bigger, could grow back. Depending on the VEV of C and where I am in Kähler moduli space, these couplings could be suppressed by two relative orders. So with that choice, one heavy family, two can grow back. Suppose I had only C1 getting a VEV. In this case, there is absolutely nothing I can write down to do anything but this one coupling. So I would have only one family, heavy family perturbatively, and nothing else coming in. I would have to go to instantons in order to be able to grow anything else back. So this is just a nice example of something that could provide hierarchies within model building by looking at these types of global features. Okay, so winding myself up here. Future work. This D-term potential is a new contribution to the effective field theory. So can you combine it with non-perturbative effects? For example, instantons, if you want to grow back extra couplings. One of the persistent problems in heterotic theory is moduli stabilization. This is a very large perturbative piece of the potential that has not been considered before with natural mechanisms. These bundle transitions, being able to move between effective field theories and moreover having a geometric understanding of how these things are linked, this could be used for model building cosmology. You can roll around one of these corners, change the spectrum in your theory, go from having no matter at all to some visible matter. The main punchline of this is that everything I've said so far applies to an arbitrary heterotic theory. This is not specific to building any model. This is just something that you should factor into the game from the start. So in addition to trying to get supersymmetry somewhere in moduli space, trying to get the spectrum of the standard model, you also need to worry about what's happening globally. So understanding constraints, I've demonstrated that you could get hierarchies with such a mechanism. Understanding global U1 constraints on membrane instantons is an interesting thing to do. And you might ask, I gave you this simple picture in terms of D-terms in the effective field theory, but the hard work I still had to do geometrically in terms of finding out what was the description on the wall. I had to tell you what this bundle broke into so that we could write down this field theory and decide what happened next. You might ask, would this be possible to do entirely from the effective field theory? Could you actually look at which U1s could be consistent with anomaly cancellation and analyze this simply from a 4D perspective?
Membrane instantons, I mean, from the M-theory point of view, or?
Yes.
Okay. So this is virtual instantons.
Yes.
You may want to think about fibrillary instantons.
You could indeed.
But they don't need correct kinetic terms, right? Because they're directly intercalated.
That's a good point.
Sorry? They don't need correct kinetic terms here, because they're directly intercalated.
Okay. So what is the punchline of this talk? The message I want to everyone to go away with is that, in fact, when you talk about supersymmetry and heterotic, you have to be more specific than just saying a supersymmetric vacuum. You have to understand the substructure of the entire Kähler moduli space and the fact that there can be these stability walls. At such a stability wall, the vector bundle, in order to preserve supersymmetry, must decompose into a direct sum for any vector bundle. So I describe this in terms of these extension sequences near the wall, but in fact, any vector bundle you write down can have this property. So you could ask this for monad bundles, as I gave an example, for spectral covers. And in general, spectral cover bundles will have walls of this type. So you will have to worry about this type of structure for a spectral cover. The bundle decomposition gives you this extra U1 in the visible theory. The U1 leads to a D-term, which correctly models slope stability from the effective field theory point of view. The one-loop correction preserves the notion of stability, but incorporates dilaton and fibrain moduli. Stability walls can lead to transitions between different bundles, different geometries, and this Kähler cone substructure can lead to constraints on phenomenology. So Yukawa textures, vector-like pair masses, etc. And I think that is it.
If I could just make a comment here. What is the right word? The globality, the globalness of all of this is actually what really matters here, because she didn't give an example. She talked about changing from one bundle into another. But in fact, just pick a bundle in one chamber, one stable chamber. It can have entire structure of stability walls, not just one. It can have several. If you go to higher dimensional Kayla cones, it can have a very intricate structure of these things.
And all of them matter.
And all of them matter. So in fact, the analysis of heterotic string theory, if you're doing phenomenology anywhere in this region, will have a very intricate structure. And we give examples in our paper of how this happens. So just going to one-dimensional boundary, for instance, and getting an extra U1, anomalous U1, that's part of the story, but that's just one small part of the global story. I think that's an important point.
Yep. And the fact that you can have multiple walls, all of which see each other, is something that I didn't mention and is very important.
And this is basically because the gauge field propagated in all 10 dimensions of the heterotic theory, right? I mean,
yeah.
You can do local modeling and test here a little more.
Yes.
And the other thing, so I've used the word global here loosely, but all of this is being driven by anomaly cancellation as well. So it was the Bianchi identity which was giving me this bit of the effective field theory. So in some sense, anomaly cancellation is seeing everything. Any other questions?
The multi ones on the type 2 side are multi-brain, different brains.
I mean, for what we're describing, these are actually, so you could have two walls and they're the same bundle, despite the fact that you have multi-U1s, or even multi-U1s coming from just one wall.
You must be able to, in type 2, get multi-U1s on the same stack of D-brains if you put the right Wilson lines to break things down. I guess you could do, that would be a similar thing. If you broke up a bundle on a set of D-brains and got some, there must be sort of parallel.
It's a good question. Any other comments, questions? Okay, thank you.